for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The homeless mentally ill have become a fixture in the American urban landscape. Seeing them on the street can make many of us feel uncomfortable and even frightened. Dr. Robert Okun set out to confront his own fears. He got to know more than 40 mentally ill homeless men and women in San Francisco over 2 years. Now he's sharing their stories in a new book titled Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street. Dr. Okun joins me in the studio. We'll welcome your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Dr. Okun, it's good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Diane.
My pleasure. Dr. Okun, tell me about that moment in time when you realized you wanted to get started on this project.
Well, I had been chief of psychiatry at San Francisco General Hospital for about 17 years. And when I left that position, I just had this craving to try to understand how people on the street actually lived. You know, I obviously had understood that from a clinical point of view from my position in the hospital, but it's very different trying to understand it actually on their turf. And I suppose there was a moment when I decided that I just had to do this. I was going to my car, hurrying to my car one winter rainy night in San Francisco, and I saw a woman lying on the street getting rained on. She was shivering and obviously cold, and I just couldn't get her out of my mind. Here I was with an umbrella hurrying to get to my car. I had some place to go. I could get out of the rain. She was going no place. And I wondered how she was going to stand it that night and then the next day and the next night and so on. And for some reason, I just couldn't get her out of my mind. And I wondered how she was going to get her clothes dry, how she was going to go to the bathroom when there weren't any public bathrooms around, how she was going to eat, where she was going to sleep the next few nights, and so on. So I decided I was going to spend a couple of years on the streets talking to people and trying to find out the answers to these questions.
Obviously not living on the street yourself.
No, I didn't live on the street. I got there about 6 in the morning, and I left about 11 o'clock at night.
I see. And early on in your book, Silent Voices, you talk about a woman named Bridget. Tell us about her.
Well, Bridget was a woman who told me that she had fallen from the Empire State Building to the curb. She had been sexually abused by her stepfather in her early life and had actually done quite well for herself during her adolescence. And during her adulthood, she actually got a good job. But her daughter was raped by her daughter's uncle, and that brought back all of the memories of her own sexual abuse. She began taking drugs and alcohol and lost everything. She was on the street for some years, became seriously addicted to alcohol, and ultimately, despite the efforts of a lot of people to help her, ultimately died one night of alcohol poisoning.
You know, I think that there are a lot of us who do see people on the street bundled, no matter what the temperature. It might be 90 degrees and people are in layer after layer of clothing. And we do tend to shy away from them, assuming that they, number one, wish to be left alone, and number two, have established a life pattern for themselves, and that any attempt on our part to interrupt that life pattern would be met with hostility. What did you find?
Well, first of all, I expected when I approached people and wanted to find out about their lives, I expected that they would really treat me with disdain. You know, I was obviously the well-heeled guy on the street. I didn't have the authority of being a doctor in a hospital. I was a doctor, but I was on the street on their turf. And I thought that they would turn me away. And I was actually quite anxious that that would happen. But what I found was just the opposite. About 70% of people really seemed to welcome my approach and wanted to talk about their lives.
Give me, if you can, take us back to that first encounter you had the courage to make, what you said, and how you were received.
Well, first of all, I have to say I was so uneasy about this project that I actually had to stalk somebody before I worked up the courage to talk to them. I wasn't afraid of them. I was just afraid that they would turn me away, basically, because now I was the supplicant. I was the panhandler with the tin cup. I needed something from them, their stories, their photographs, and so on. So I approached someone, and I said to them that I was thinking of working on a book that allowed people who were obviously struggling with mental illness and homelessness to tell their stories to the public. And I asked them whether I could also photograph them because while they were telling about their stories, because I found their faces beautiful in some way. You know, the hardship that they lived with was just etched onto their faces.
And, of course, this book is made up not only of the narratives, but of those very photographs.
Yes, I had hoped that the photographs would draw people into the narratives, that when people actually looked at these people and didn't turn away from them, but looked at their photographs, as it were, that they would get interested in what made this person homeless.
So what happened the first time you attempted?
Yeah, so I asked them, and the
male
person said
female?
it was a man, and he told me about his story.
What did you say to him?
Well, I said to him that I wanted to give people who were obviously struggling a voice in the public arena. I knew that they were stigmatized. I knew that they were seen at best as invisible and at worst as pariahs. And that people, and that I believed if people really heard their stories, they would extend kindness to them rather than blame. That's what I said.
And how did he respond?
He said that he was willing to talk to me. And what I expected was a kind of sanitized story. And instead, I got a story that was very moving and was obviously told to me with candor. He had tears in his eyes through most of the interview.
What made you think he was mentally ill, if he could relate that story to you?
Well, there's a kind of common misperception that people who are mentally ill can't interact in any kind of normal way with someone else, and that's just not true. So as I began to talk to him, he initially was a little defensive, but although he welcomed my approach, but he warmed up to me after he saw that I was really interested in him as a human being.
And once again, how did you know he was mentally ill?
Well, he was talking to himself, and he seemed very distracted, and he had several of the stigmata of mental illness.
Of course, the question I would raise would be whether he was mentally ill before he began living on the streets, or whether living on the streets had created that kind of mental illness. Dr. Robert Okun is with me. He's a practicing clinical psychiatrist, professor emeritus at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. His new book is titled Silent Voices. Short break.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Staples, offering laptops, tablets, and e-readers. Open extended hours Friday the 28th. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. From Fleischman Hillard, a global communications firm specializing in public relations, public affairs, marketing, and social media. FleischmanHillard.com. And from Lee and Stuart Rolfe, supporting the StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative, which shares the stories of veterans and their families.
If you just joined us, Dr. Robert Okun is with me. He's a practicing clinical psychiatrist, professor emeritus at the University of California at San Francisco School of Medicine. He's former commissioner of mental health in both Vermont and Massachusetts. He's written a new book. It's all about people with mental disorders who live on the street. His book is titled Silent Voices. Dr. Okun, earlier you talked about Bridget and the fact that she began to use drugs. Now, was she using drugs before she became a person who lived on the street, or did the drugs come afterwards?
Well, she was using drugs before, but she had them under control. But after her daughter was raped, she completely lost control, and she became strung out on the drugs and then lost everything. So it was a little of both. And once she got on the streets, her drug intake increased because the harshness of the street was so great that she kind of treated herself to and changed her changed her mental state, so she didn't have to deal with just how grim life was on the streets.
You talk about the fact that 40% of the women you interviewed on the street had been abused as children.
Yes, it was shocking just how many of the women had been sexually abused as children. What tended to happen is they were abused, and some of them, most of them, were neglected in one way or another, and they began to become symptomatic as children. They developed stomach pains and headaches. They got distracted. They couldn't follow in school. And when they entered their adolescence, they began using drugs and acting out. Some of them became promiscuous and engaged in other kind of self-destructive behaviors. They fell further behind in school, and they entered adulthood with really no employable skills. And they, between the fact that they didn't have any employable skills and their symptoms from their early abuse, homelessness was almost guaranteed.
After working as a clinician for so long in a hospital, University of California at San Francisco, and treating individuals with psychiatric problems, what did you hope to accomplish by writing the book?
Well, I wanted to try to destigmatize this population. I wanted to try to give these people a human face. I wanted to try to give the reader a sense that underneath their rags and behind their carts and strange behaviors, that they were really people like us, and people with longings and joys and dreams and regrets, and that there were more commonalities between us than differences. Now, why did I want to do this? Because I thought that since the real struggle and the real solution here is at the ballot box, I thought that if people developed a kind of empathy for this group of people, that the public would respond by voting for additional housing and case management, which are the real solutions to this problem.
An awful lot of people would say that the deinstitutionalization of this population is what started the homeless crisis to begin with back in the 70s when institutions like St. Elizabeth's here in Washington was closed down, that somehow those in power and maybe physicians themselves decided that institutionalization was not the answer.
Yes, there was a broad consensus on both the left and the right that institutionalization was not the answer. On the right, there was a desire to save money. I would say on the left, there was an interest in civil liberties of these people and getting them treated in the community. There was a promise that when institutions were closed, that the money from the institutions would follow them into the community.
A promise and that, not kept.
A promise absolutely not kept. Now, I have to say that the better functioning of the patients left the institution, and for them, deinstitutionalization was really a blessing.
But that was
a small,
surely a very small.
It was
minority.
A small population. The rest of the population entered communities that weren't prepared to accept them, that were actively hostile to them, government agencies that were totally disorganized and uncoordinated, and basically with no services. And it should have been obvious that what people needed most was they needed housing and they needed a human relationship with a clinician.
But, of course, there are many shelters to which the homeless population refuses to go?
Well, there are two answers to that. First of all, in general, there aren't anywhere near the number of shelter beds
needed.
In San Francisco, for example, there are about 1,000 shelter beds, and there are approximately 8,000 people on the street. So it's ridiculous to think that the number of shelter beds is adequate. So that's one issue. The second issue is that there are some people who don't want to go to shelters. And when I ask them, well, how can you stand being out in the weather rather than go into some kind of shelter? They said, look, we're afraid of shelters. Our experience in them has been that our possessions get stolen. We're afraid that because we're sleeping so close to other people that we'll get their infections. And some people who are somewhat paranoid just can't tolerate the closeness of other people.
I want to go back to something I said just before the break, and that is to ask you about how many people who are now homeless were mentally ill before they got on the street, and how many became mentally ill once they began living on the street?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. There's no question that living on the streets really aggravates the symptoms of mental illness. It compromises their physical and tenuous psychological stability. It tends to increase their propensity to take drugs. It wipes them out, basically. So living on the street definitely can create mental illness, especially for people who are vulnerable, either because of their childhood trauma, or because of some biological predisposition. But a lot of people were mentally ill before they got onto the streets.
And how many would you say had been drug users / addicts before they got on the street as opposed to after?
Well, one person told me that you either needed to be crazy or stoned to survive on the street. So with that as a backdrop, I would say that most people who got on the street, who were mentally ill before they became homeless. But once they become homeless, their symptoms get aggravated, and it's very hard for them to take medication once they're on the street.
Dr. Okin, what was your goal? Did you have a sense that what you could do by both photographing them, and we should point out that you not only asked permission beforehand, but at the end of each interview, you wanted to reconfirm that they were okay with your using their photograph and using their narrative. What did you hope? I mean, people can look at this book and think, oh, my God, they're but for the grace of God. They can look at this book and see a man who has lost so many teeth. He's ashamed to be in any company whatsoever. You can look at a photograph of someone who has perhaps 10 layers of clothing on, who's wrapped up in the corner of a bus shelter. Is that photograph or is that narrative likely to change our behavior, those of us who do not dwell on the street?
Well, that's what I hoped. I hoped when, at the simplest level, that when people passed someone who was homeless and caught their eye, that they would first of all just simply acknowledge their existence rather than looking away. So at the simplest level, I wanted there to be some human connection. And I did think that if readers really heard the stories of these people that it would change their behavior in that respect. I always carry an extra pair of socks with me and give them to people whose feet I can see are infected and beaten up. It's a simple thing. So just as individuals, we can do little things like that. But what I hoped mostly was that people would demand that their senators and legislators and the president do something about this problem rather than just abandoning these people.
To what extent have you gotten reaction from professionals or ordinary people who've read the book?
I have gotten reactions, and I would say 90% of the reactions have been something like this. We didn't really know what it was like before we read the book. We didn't know the nitty-gritty of what it was like to be on the street, how harsh it was, how difficult it was to climb out of homelessness once you got into it, and just how little chance these people had right from the beginning of their lives. And it increased our sense of empathy for this group of people.
How did they find food?
Well, that's a tough question. Some of them go to soup kitchens, but others who were less functional, frankly, dig into dumpsters and garbage, grab a half-eaten sandwich and half a cup of coffee, and basically live like that.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Would you read us a couple of paragraphs, starting on page 112? There's a story here about that gentleman who was so concerned about the way he looked.
Well, it begins by saying, I turn away and cover my mouth when a woman smiles at me. She'd never look at me again if she saw I had no teeth. Even if I got dentures, it wouldn't help because it's not going to fool her. As soon as we kissed, she'd realize it. She'd be completely disgusted and think I'd misled her. She'd drop me like a hot potato. Better not to let anything start. It would be too painful. I've been telling myself, quit looking at women. You're just torturing yourself. It's not going to happen. You're going to be alone all your life. It's wicked sad, but that's the way it is. I'm just doomed. You know, if you have a big nose, well, no one can blame you. It's just the way you were born. But if you have no teeth, it's proof that you've screwed up real bad, that you must be nothing but a screw-up.
So you, Jeff was referred to you by a case management program at San Francisco General Hospital, and he had been using drugs shortly before you met him. Tell us how that conversation between the two of you went.
Well, he told me about his early life, first of all. His mother had been schizophrenic and had been in and out of mental hospitals, and he was always terrified at night that she would come and stab him with a knife. So he always slept, in a sense, with one eye open. He, however, despite this background, was able to get a job as a garbage man. But he lost it when some pot was discovered in his urine. He then became very depressed because his job was everything for him. He felt like he had really transcended his childhood. He lost his job And when he did, he became very depressed, couldn't get out of bed, began using drugs, and then lost his girlfriend as well. So he lost everything, and he was basically thrown out onto the street because he had no money at all. And he lived on the street for 10 years. He developed dental abscesses, which are very common on the street because people can't brush their teeth.
And very painful.
And very painful. Imagine. Yeah, I have to say, when I had breakfast with him every month for a couple of years, and I could see how difficult it was for him to eat. You know, he would chew with his gums and then swallow the rest of his food whole.
Dr. Robert Okun, his new book is titled Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street. Short break, your calls when we come back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, at roadscholar.org. From T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com. And from the Joyce Foundation, working to encourage businesses and consumers to save money and electricity through energy efficiency. JoyceFDN.org.
Thanks for the memory.
That's Bob Hope in 1938, singing for the first time the song that would become his signature. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with his biographer, Richard Zoglin. Zoglin argues that Hope was the most popular entertainer of the 20th century. Join us.
For the memory of candlelight and wine, castles on the Rhine, the Parthenon, and moments.
Dr. Robert Okun is with me. He's a practicing clinical psychiatrist, professor emeritus at the University of California at San Francisco School of Medicine, former commissioner of mental health in Vermont and Massachusetts. He's written a new book titled Silent Voices, all about people with mental disorders living on the street. Before we open the phones or read email, you were talking about Jeff, who suffered so terribly from loss of teeth. Tell us what became of him.
Well, he developed a dental infection which traveled to his heart. And he had to be hospitalized and was hospitalized for many months at a cost of about $500,000.
The taxpayers.
Yes, yes. This is an expensive problem not to solve. It's less expensive to solve it, and there's good evidence for that. But anyway, getting back to Jeff, a social worker visited him in the hospital and developed a relationship with him. She got him housing and got him on SSI, And ultimately, he stopped using drugs, and he is now working half-time. So this is a real success story, and I would say that the credit goes to that social worker who developed a relationship with him.
I should say. All right, let's go to Phoenix, Arizona, and to Leonard. Hi, Leonard. You're on the air.
Well, Diane, first of all, I just want to say what an honor. I've listened to you and been educated by you for many decades, and so it's finally an honor, and I will cherish the fact that I got to speak with you.
Thank
you. You're one of my heroes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm calling because we have a lot of nice people here in the Phoenix metro area and in Arizona in general, but I and a lot of my friends, you know, we care about our homeless shelter we have here, but we're greatly concerned because we believe our public and our elected officials, while telling us they're concerned about the homeless and mentally ill, are criminalizing them. And to just illustrate that, Diane, and also thank you to the author, because I'm definitely going to get a copy of your book somehow, some way. But to illustrate that, last week at our Phoenix City Council meeting, they passed an emergency rule, because we have our Super Bowl coming here in February, stating that people asking for food, asking for money, whatever have you, cannot stand in the medians where they have been for many decades. So now if these poor people, they're going to have a $250 fine the first time if they don't pay. From what I understand, they can be jailed. And then the second time, they'll be given the punishment of a crime that's up there with the DUI, 6 months in jail. And I'm not sure if it's several thousand dollars fine, but I'm just worried. We're worried. The folks that we know here, like one man I work with, I can't get him to go in the shelter. He's obviously mentally ill. He goes off on these rants about conspiracies against him and all of these things. I can't get him to go in. What happens when they criminalize him, his mental illness? And so that's what I'm hoping that our leaders here in Arizona will listen to this author and your show and put their actions to words, not to criminalize people for being mentally ill or hungry, you know?
Yes, you're absolutely right. About 15 to 20% of people in jails and prisons are there because they're mentally ill. And unfortunately, jail and prison tends to aggravate their symptoms. And the treatment in most of these facilities are either bad or non-existent. So the fact that political leadership, often supported by the public, I have to say, passed laws that criminalize these people is just absolutely criminal in itself, in my opinion.
Now, do you know of communities that make public feeding of homeless people illegal? Gail has posted that question on Facebook.
I don't, but it seems to be a trend that at least in some urban areas, there are laws against feeding people, against panhandling. And there are actually about 30 communities that have passed what are called sit-lie laws, which make it illegal to either sit or lie on the sidewalk during the day.
And apparently Florida was recently in the news for this. Here's an email from Mary, who said she's just returned to Baltimore after a weekend in New York City. She was shocked to see so many homeless people there in New York. One young man approached her on the subway begging for money for a bus ticket home to Montana. She says, "I so wanted to give him money, but was afraid it would just go to alcohol or drugs. Was I wrong?" she says, "or were my suspicions sadly correct? What does your guest believe I should have done?"
Well, I think you have to make a decision on a case-by-case basis. I sometimes give money to people when I have talked to them for a while and believe that they're really going to use it for what they say. But I'm prepared to be wrong about that. In a way, I'd rather be wrong than be withholding in certain cases. In other cases where it's obvious that it's going to go for alcohol or drugs, I tend to buy people a sandwich rather than give them money.
All right. To Steve in Lansing, Michigan. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane, for taking my call.
Surely.
I am a recovering addict of 13 years. I struggled with drugs and alcohol after I came out of the service in the 70s and carried it on into civilian life. But because of circumstances of really, you know, hitting bottom, I was able to seek treatment. I believe it's a such thing as acquired mental illness. I feel when I was growing up, I had learning disabilities, and I just sort of built onto that with, you know, that was the people that accepted me. I was told in school I wasn't smart, I wasn't good, and I sort of acquired a lot of my thoughts. But once I got in, acclimated back to the human, because we do, we get detached from humanity, and we get isolated and lonely. But once we're able to come back and reattach to humanity, then all the help that's out there for us will work. I just wondered what his feelings was on that.
One eloquent statement.
Yes. Well, I think the caller is absolutely right, and I think his experience has been replicated by other people. What is first needed with people who are detached and people who feel like a failure from the beginning? It seems like our caller really, really eloquently stated that. He just felt like a failure right from the beginning of his life and got drawn into drugs that way. The most important thing we can do is to have social workers that have the time and the caseload to develop a human relationship with these individuals, to reattach them. And that takes time. They've got to meet them where they are. They can't expect them to come to a clinic. The social workers have to go out into the street and meet them in bars, on the street, in churches, and so on and so forth. And over time, most people, even people who are very psychotic or very involved with drugs, are able to respond to that kind of clinical wisdom and caring.
Let's see. We had an email from Rhonda who says the quote from a mentally ill person describing his suffering due to loss of teeth really touched my heart. My own stepson, who is paranoid schizophrenic, almost died last year due to a dental abscess. I've written a proposal to increase the availability of dental care for persons with mental illness in Montgomery County, Maryland, first by finding dentists willing to do pro bono work, and ultimately to advocate for legislation that would include dental care for adults on Medicaid.
Crucial, absolutely crucial. What tends to happen is when people develop dental abscesses on the street, which they're very susceptible to, if they go to a hospital, it's much cheaper for the dentist to simply pull the tooth rather than repair it. And that's why so many people have lost their teeth. So including dental care in Medicaid, I think, would be a tremendous boon.
But the idea of the man, Jeff, that you profiled here, costing the hospital and taxpayers some $500,000 ought to be a wake-up call for everybody.
Well, it should be. And I think one of the reasons it's not is because this group of people is so stigmatized. We treat them with such revulsion that we either want to forget them and marginalize them and push them to the edges of society and just ignore them because we don't like them. We don't like them. We're afraid of them. And we blame them for their own homelessness.
Let's go to Bonita Springs, Florida. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Good morning here. I guess it's still morning there, too.
Sure is.
San Francisco. Hey, this is a great program. I just want to thank this Dr. Okun for doing this project. I don't know where to begin, but this is everything he's saying is so true. I experienced all this firsthand myself. Along with many colleagues, I was a paramedic for over 20 years in the Bay Area, in Oakland and San Francisco. I began in 1985. That was 30 years ago. The problem in 85 was exactly how he is describing it now. So we go on decade after decade, and every once in a while somebody comes up and exposes a problem or brings it to the public's attention. And then we move on, and then another 10 years gets exposed again. It's not because of a lack of resources or lack of people that are willing to go out and actually work with these folks. What's missing is the fabric, is the individual thread of our society, for every single taxpayer, every voter, every member to do their little teeny, teeny part. That's how it's going to be solved.
So the question becomes, what's wrong with the systems we have in place now for helping people like this?
Well, at the deepest level, the problem is that we do not have the political will to solve this problem. And it's not just because of the politicians. The public elects the politicians, and the politicians are responding to the feelings of the public. So I believe it is a cultural phenomenon, and when these people become less stigmatized, then things will change. I also want to say that there are some states that have done something about this. This is an eminently solvable problem. Utah is an example of that.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What has Utah done?
Well, it's developed a program that's being sponsored actually by the federal government called Housing First. And it basically provides housing. It's a simple project. It provides affordable housing for chronically homeless people without requiring that they take their medication first or that they become clean and sober first, which has been, unfortunately, the traditional approach to this. So this new approach, which is put people in housing and then you can treat them. The result of that is that their chronically homeless population has decreased by 70% in the last 8 or 9 years. Proof that this can work.
But how realistically are they able to maintain even the living quarters they have and still be on drugs or alcohol or what have you?
Well, first of all, about 85 or 90% of people who are housed under this project remained housed. They did not blow out of their housing as was expected. And the fact is that it's very hard to treat people who are actually living on the street. They can't take their medications. They can't store them. They can't keep track of them. They can't get them. And the only way that they have a hope of being treated is being housed first. I mean, just think about what it would be like to live on the streets and try to take care of yourself, try to deal with your substance abuse problem, your psychiatric problem. It's impossible when you're on the streets. When you're housed, there's really a chance. And the experience is that when people are housed, they're much more willing to take psychiatric medication, much more willing to have their substance abuse problems treated because they're not struggling for physical survival every day of the year.
And are we seeing more and more children on the street?
Well, there's been a report released recently that suggests that there's been an 8% increase in homeless children. That's a discouraging figure. HUD did a what's called a point-in-time study recently that showed that there were 140,000 people, kids on the street under 18. This new study suggested that that using a different methodology, that about 2.5 million children were homeless at some point during the year.
And finally, an email from Jen in Maryland, who says to you, Dr. Okun, thank you for doing this project and bringing these voices to the fore. We need more people like you. Dr. Robert Okun, his new book is titled Silent Voices. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.